As always, subscribe and click the notification bell on our YouTube channel. Be active on our Facebook group, East Coast Distressed Note Investing, and be sure to go to our website for all your note investing tools, resources, and available assets. If you have any questions, email us at tradedesk@jkpholdings.com.
We're talking about this with a couple of investors.
Yeah.
And we ran this in our class that we had just a few weeks ago, which we'll be rerunning in January 3rd, about this idea of bidding on performing and non-performing. What entails, what goes into it? Why do you use one or the other? And what are some of the pitfalls? So
yeah,
I want to dive into it. Before we get there, though, how are things with you? What's going on with your world? How are notes? Have you seen an influx recently? What are you seeing recently?
I have seen a bit of an influx. I'm talking with a few sellers who are talking about some big tapes coming through here in the next few weeks, which is interesting. It just, points to what we've been talking about for the last couple of years, where we're anticipating seeing a lot more coming available for us to purchase, which is kind of the good news, bad news. It's good for us, bad news for a lot of folks. But again, we're there to help, and hopefully we can help out a lot more people. So that's good. How about you? You've seen a lot more coming through?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of mixture of both. Some funds send some things out, but we're also getting an influx of those people who joined us 2 weeks ago, some seller finance people looking to sell seconds or second convert to first and sort of that. And that led to more discussions, which we're finding out is really cool because these people are amazed at what we can do to solve their problem. And for me, that's the key here, because these people, we're helping them get rid of assets or refinance the restoration into something they can actually make some money and go redo. So those who are watching us again, we're great on feedback. Send us some assets so we can look, and we'll share with you some information, but know the fact that we need some data points to run our calculations.
Yeah, I spent
I think we lost your mic for a second. Did you mute? No. I don't know if we lost your mic or are we, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, there we are. We're back.
Okay. Yeah, I was saying I spent about an hour with a friend of ours here this last week with looking over a bunch of her assets she's got for sale. It's some good stuff. It just needs a little bit of tweaking before it can be something that we can look at purchasing.
Yeah.
But got her hooked up with a servicer so it can help sort out, at the very least, the pay history, because that was the number one thing. We couldn't actually tell what her unpaid balance was because she hadn't been recording it properly, which only because she doesn't know how else to do it. And so that's what we're here to do, and help people figure out how to do this. We will buy these loans. We just need them the way we need them.
Yeah. And I think people are learning quickly what that means, right? The idea of what the loans are set up to be is important for us. And the fact that when the data points are in the right kind of setup, we can evaluate things much faster. And it helps us know what we need to do to move forward in the asset evaluation and what questions to ask. We did share a spreadsheet that kind of helped get those data points from those seller finance people. But on the flip side, when we're evaluating these assets, we run different determinations to decide what we're going to bid on it. If it's performing or non-performing, it depends, right? So Nathan,
The answer that nobody likes to hear, but that's the truth. It does depend, and we need certain things to be able to make it work properly, but we're here to help. We're here to help figure that out for people.
And yes, Nathan's having some kind of video issue. We'll work through it, and hopefully everything will work out okay. But when we look at these kind of things, we want to make sure that we're valuing these assets correctly. We don't want to just win an asset. We want to make sure we bid and be successful with our offers. But that doesn't mean always winning an offer. It just means that we make a bid that makes sense to those people out there to a seller, but also to ourselves. We don't want to be in a spot where we make an offer, the seller accepts it, and it doesn't make a good return for us.
Right.
So Nathan, when you get an asset, one of the first things you look at is what? You know, what are some of the things you look at?
So I'll get a tape. There's a number of things that I look off right up off top of the, you know, right when I first get it. One of the very first things I look at is location. There are certain states that just through experience, I've learned kind of the hard way that they're difficult to deal in. So I skip over certain states. One of the other key things that I look at that kind of goes along with our discussion here today is I'm looking at last date paid or and next date due. I want to know what the pay history is going into this to this loan to see sure. where it's at. How likely is it to start reperforming, or is it performing already? And just so I have the story of where is it today, so I can know where to take it next.
Yeah. And I think that's important for most people who don't get what we're looking for. When an asset's performing, you have to make sure that you know the fact that how many payments are left, what numbers go into it, because you can't bid strictly based on certain data points. If you're bidding on a note, right? You're bidding on the term, you're bidding on the rate, you're bidding on a IOU. And if you're looking at one part of the IOU and not others, you make a really big issue with it. It could cause a big problem for you because your returns won't equal what you think they are. Right. And that's where I think people fault is they kind of make an offer that the seller will accept, but at the flip side, it doesn't work in their returns when they run the final numbers.
Yeah. Sorry with my video here. I'm just trying to do some things, shut down some other windows or something, get this moving a little bit better.
Friday afternoon, I think our computer's getting tired. So when we look at these things, we look at the fact that these assets are performing, what numbers go into are things like, what is the interest rate? Because that determines what kind of return we're going to get because the P&I is based off that number and the UPB. So if that rate's a 2 or 3, it makes it extremely difficult for us to make an offer on it and get it up to a 10 yield because of that problem. But however, there are times where performing asset, you can bid as a performing asset.
Right, right. And a lot of that has to do with that interest rate. And so yeah. if it's a 3% interest rate, that's going to be a very tough, a tough one for me to bid on just yeah. because I'm going to have to discount it. A large amount for me to be able to get the return that I'm looking for versus something that's written at like an 8, 9, 10% interest rate.
The reason is that rate that comes in is the gross return of what that asset is going to interest is going to kick out. So the fact that if it's an 8%, it's kicking out an 8% return every year, right? When if the 3% is kicking at 3%. So to right. get that 3% up to an 8, you got to discount so much that it drives that 3 up higher because you're into it for X dollar. A $100,000 note at 3% kicks out 3% a year. Where to get it up to an 8, you got to buy that $100,000 note for such a discount using your financial calculator to get to a point where you're paying 10, 12, 15 a year because you're not buying it at 100% of that value.
Right. And the argument can easily be made that. Well, you know, it's a 30-year amortization, but they're probably going to pay off in a shorter amount of time than that. That's probably true.
Yes.
We don't know. So we have to go with what we have today. That's the only information that we can work off of. I can't guess that maybe 5 years or 7 years from now, they're going to refinance or sell the house or something. I can't hypothecate and hope to make money at some time in the future. It has to be based on today's numbers.
Absolutely. And I think for most people, they don't understand that. And math is difficult. And the financial part of it is extremely difficult. But if you originate notes, or if you understand how notes are originated, the numbers that go into that origination is the exact same numbers we're working with, because yield is interest rate, right? Yeah. And if you're looking for a certain return a year, that's the number you're going to play with. And that performing asset, if it continues to perform to maturity date, you're going to get that return every year until the maturity date. And that's one of the reasons why we don't target percentage of UPB. because that actually doesn't work for you, because it just it doesn't calculate the interest rate, which also drives in your returns.
And that's the thing. It could work. If the interest rate happens to be at the right amount, but if it's not, then you've just shot yourself in the foot and you've made a terrible investment. So
if you see a loan written at a 13, 14, which you're probably going to start seeing in the seller finance world, according to Max.
Yeah.
Would you bid that 100% of UPB?
Honestly, probably not. I'm probably still going to discount it at least some because of the risk that I'm taking on. You know, and again, there's other factors that go into it. How much equity is in there? What's the property value? Where is it located? Sure. What kind of contract is coming through? Okay.
Yeah, my internet, I think, buffered for a second, so I apologize for everyone. It has been a crazy Friday.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Something's funky here.
I know. So on the flip side, though, the one time you can truly go off a performing asset, any one time, is if you're buying a partial, right? Why is that? You have a beginning and set date. If it goes non-performing, you really don't want to worry about it. So you actually can bid based on yield because you have a set start date and maturity date, and that bond expires that you're probably not going to sell it before that,
right?
Unless it pays off, right? And you can never predict that part of it. However, you know, for me, you can literally bid on yield on a partial every day of the week and count on it because, again, defaults, the seller kicks back in.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're buying these performing assets that are performing for 2, 3, 4 years, let's flip it over. Does non-performing ever trickle in the head? Like, it's been performing for 3, 4 years. I'm going to sell this asset at a great 12 yield, but in the non-performing world, that may be a really low return because of certain situations.
Right.
Do you even care about that?
A strong pay history definitely helps. That makes me feel a lot more warm and fuzzy. And it makes me much more comfortable. But there's always that possibility. And economy, you know, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen down the road? And I can't 100% say that just because they've made payments the last 24 months, they're going to continue to make payments for the next 28 years. There's no guarantee there. So it's always in the back of my mind. It's always something that I have to at least factor for.
Yeah. And I have to agree with you. I bid everything, unless the partial, based on a non-performing calculator that includes performing.
Yeah.
And again, those we'll have on next, on December 30th, two of the classmates that took our last class explained some of what was going through their heads before they took the class and what their mindset changed. So please definitely tune in for it. We have Candace and David on in 2 weeks because you can bid everything as a performing asset because they're performing before, but you never know what's going to happen in the future.
Right.
You can't guarantee you're going to have a 20-year note for 12% a year and nothing happens to it.
Right.
So when you flip over the non-performing world, it's a lot of differences in opinions. You and I differ in our opinions as much as anyone else would.
Yeah.
But why, besides the fact that if a loan is performing and it could not perform, why is calculating a non-performing asset important and saying, screw it, it's foreclosure, I don't got to worry about anything? What other factors do you agree with that come into play when it goes non-performing? Why is non-performing asset a concern?
That's always a concern. So, I mean, I was having a discussion with somebody just the other day, and we were talking about just locally here. There was a development that was going up and about 10 years ago and out of the blue, for no reason that anybody knows of, and there's obviously reasons, but for whatever reason, the developer stopped, whether they ran out of money or ran into some other kind of trouble or something. And so development just stopped. So you've got a bunch of houses that are either completed or partially completed that are now just sitting vacant. A vacant property deteriorates surprisingly quickly. And it makes no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever that just because it's empty shouldn't make that much difference, but it does. It makes a huge difference. All of a sudden things start breaking where it's, you know, people had lived there for 5 years and everything was fine. And then all of a sudden it's been vacant a year and all kinds of things start happening, whether it's just natural or from vandalism. So that's always a concern. That's always something that I'm thinking of. And, you know, how long has it been empty and how long could it be empty until something happens? And it's always a concern. So we're always looking at that possibility.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think also kind of play is that each state is different, right? The house deteriorates, but each state, you can't guarantee that Texas is going to be like Ohio, which would be like Florida, which would be like New Jersey, like California. Each state has a different way to it, right? An asset that may work in Texas, the pricing may not work in New Jersey because of taxes, property taxes, foreclosure laws. And you have to price it accordingly because of that problem. And if you bid your Texas asset like you do an Ohio asset, you can run into a lot of problems. Cost and time frame adds up because you have more expenses in a state that takes longer. Property taxes, servicing fees, forced place insurance, and more time for that property to kind of get beat up.
And a classic example of that is let's take Ohio and Texas. So Ohio, for whatever reason, has very high taxes. You can be in Cleveland or Columbus or somewhere, and the taxes are for the same value property, the taxes will be a double or triple in Ohio versus Texas. So if you've got even 6 months worth of non-payment and you're responsible for those taxes, that can make an enormous difference between those two states. For, you know, everything else being equal, that can make a huge difference to your numbers.
Yeah. And I know some people use a flat foreclosure cost thing. And for the most part, that can be somewhat accurate. And you can dive into deeper once you get into due diligence on things, but you need to make sure you calculate the foreclosure costs and time frames. You also have to include things like the servicing fee, because if it goes not performing, you're not foreclosing the next day, right? That comes into play that whatnot happens. And I think most people forget that because they just say, listen, I'm foreclosed. It's all good. I have enough money set aside. And especially if you're buying assets that are less than 50,000, that foreclosure costs, and if you're in Ohio, that property tax will eat up a lot of your profit quickly before you even foreclose on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
$3,000-$4,000 a year can eat up a lot, plus your $6,000-$7,000 for your foreclosure fee. You're looking at easily $10,000 in foreclosing with the property tax tacked onto it.
Right. And heaven forbid the taxes get sold to a tax lien buyer. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they've jacked on 18% interest and it gets very expensive very quickly.
Yeah.
This is all stuff that we cover in our class, and we had a great discussion on this and went over it in detail.
If you don't calculate this stuff,
you
need to learn it. And I get it. We talked for a while about giving out our calculator, but what we found out is that most people don't understand it, and they really need to understand how to build their own and how to maneuver their own. And Candace and Dave will talk about how they started developing their own calculator so they can calculate their own thing and figure out things on their own. In our class talks, we spend 2 weeks developing the calculator that you're going to use. So that is extremely important. In part of that non-performing calculator, you can include a performing feature that if it continues to perform, it's okay, right? And if that is your hurdle because of the 3% loan, then that will trigger it and say, okay, this is, I have to bid this much to make sure it makes sense for me. But you got to also include, reason we ask for like what's the next due date is that there's also a situation where even a non-performing asset can flip to performing.
Right.
And if you are in a spot where you're just bidding on non-performing bids, expecting to get the property, you're in a rude awakening because it can reinstate at any moment for whatever reason and go performing. And if that's a 3%, 2% coupon interest rate, right, you can be in a really bad spot quickly when they put a bunch of money down, you can't mod the deal, and you move forward with the idea that you're going to get the property. And in turn, you start getting payments, which you think is great, However, if you bid this thing way too low or too high, you're not going to get the return you're targeting, even if performing. You know, I made the mistake years ago. Yeah. So reinstatement happens.
Yeah. And sometimes that's exactly what you want. And sometimes that's your worst nightmare.
Yes.
And it's the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah.
So, and again, you have to be prepared for all of these different possibilities. And that's part of that is building out your calculator to say, so if this happens, if that happens, if this happens, if that happens, and to the best of our ability, trying to work that out and see what could happen.
Yeah. And that's the key.
So many things.
We don't know what's going to happen. And we've heard people say, well, you know, I've been taught that you can go into a deal knowing what the bar is probably going to do. That's wonderful, but that's as far as you can take it. Right.
Yeah.
Don't count on the borrower to do what you think it's going to do because you don't know the borrower's situation 100%.
Yeah. Don't. And people don't always do the logical, rational thing.
This is a house. This is their home.
Oh, yeah. We've both seen that several times over where if they did this, that's the most logical. That makes the most sense. But for whatever reason, they do that.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I do see the fact that we have a question from Alan regarding can property tax be added to legal collectible balance of a property that goes in foreclosure? And yes, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Pretty much anything you add as a collectible balance could be insurance, it could be whatever. And also read over your note, make sure what can and cannot be added. And depending on state laws, things like your foreclosure costs, your attorney costs, certain states like Ohio, you can add that to it.
Right.
Some states you can. Some states you can add it to your, your reinstatement, but you can't add it to your collectible. So those are the kind of things that come into play. Now, do you have to be pristine and everything? No. But you have to know the fact that you can't add certain things on all the time. And things like Ohio, which is the only state, I don't understand why they do this, is this 66% of appraisal value at foreclosure, which means that any moment that appraisal value, when you go to foreclosure in any other state, you set the bid based on whatever you want to. Ohio has this law in place that says if, I think it's three people go out, they appraise the property and you 66% of what they think the property's worth is the bid. So if you want to bid lower, you can't. You can bid higher, but you can't bid lower. Which doesn't always fare well for us.
No, not always. And again, it sounds like it should work, but it doesn't. And not always. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And you don't want to get caught in that situation if you're not prepared for it. If you're prepared for it and you've planned for it, no problem.
Yeah.
But you don't want to get caught. So you've got to know. And, you know, so going back to what you were saying before, you know, can you add, what kind of interest are you adding on at what point and all these kind of things that goes back to the origination side of things where hopefully you know how to do that. And hopefully, you know what you can do in your state or whatever state you're originating in, you've added in the correct language and terms that can be allowed for your area or wherever you're originating. So, and again, if you don't know that, learn, because it can make a huge difference.
Two points that you said, I recently had an originator come up to me and says, Dave, why do I need Dodd-Frank? I'm seller to owner occupied person. I'm allowed to do 3 a year. I'm not going to call any names for the case they're on right now. But the problem is they didn't understand that, yes, you can write three in your name as an originator. But if you're dealing with a home owner occupied, there's a set of rules done by them that needs to be followed. It's not about how many loans you can originate. It's what kind of note you can put in place. And if they're in a bad spot where you're a borrower in a really bad position, that note can be violated Dodd-Frank laws. And you really need to address that, which next month we'll be covering a lot of how to create a successful positive note, but also what can you add to it to make it more valuable, which leads to the idea of if you're originating notes and you're listening to this, adding in a servicer fee is great.
Yeah.
Right. And then you're bidding your non-performing assets, your performing assets, be sure to subtract the servicing fee unless the note includes a servicing fee inside the the P&I plus the servicing fee.
Yeah, it's kind of included in that taxes and insurance category, yep, where it's an extra fee on top of whatever the principal and interest is.
But that allows you to bid higher because you don't have to subtract your 35 right, or your 30 or 20, whatever servicer charges for your performing asset. I can literally take the entire P&I, which means my returns will go dramatically up. So if you are bidding out a building out a bid calculator, be sure to subtract that, but also have a trigger that you can adjust it and say, listen, I don't need to subtract it. But this note already includes the ability to pay for the servicing outside of this P&I payment.
Right. So let's get into preference just for fun. Ooh. What do you like better, performing and non-performing?
So it's funny you say that. You know, 3 years ago, I could care less about performing assets. I would love to do what everyone says, right? The rule of thumb was buy a non-performing and flip it over to performing. And I think it was talked about so much, people thought it was normal.
Right.
It was a goal, not something we can always achieve. And you hoped and you try working things out to make it happen. But I like the non-performing because of the fact that it can skyrocket returns, ridiculous 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, ridiculous returns with non-performing, especially if they reinstate, or if you made a killer deal with the sellers, or you bought an asset where they thought the value was XYZ, and you know it was much higher than that, right? So when you're bidding on these assets, you know, make sure you look at that value of the property, part of that calculator, because that may actually give you a leg up, especially if you know the local area.
Yeah.
Now, granted, today things have changed. And for me, it's not about, do I want non-performing performing? It's what is right now, quote unquote, on sale or the best price. We're buying more performers now than we did non-performing. It used to be 85 or so percent non-performing. And now we flipped over. Now we're about 85% performing assets that we're buying simply because the return is there. We're trickling in some partials and whatnot. And we're evaluating a large commercial deal as well. But we're either buying those performing assets at a good return, or we're buying, you know, a partial situation, but we're not buying as many non-performing simply because the pricing for non-performing hasn't been there recently. But we're hearing second quarter may change a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are still deals out there and I'm still buying the non-performing, but I agree with you. And then,
yeah,
I'm buying a lot more of the performing these days than I used to. Like you say, I used to think on performing, I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
But the return wasn't attractive enough to lure me into that. And I wonder if part of it is just, I'm just getting old.
Yes. It's too much work, too much headache.
Absolutely. It is. And the performing, without question, it's a much easier thing to manage. The returns aren't as high. The potential return is not as high. But it's a lot less work.
Yeah.
And so that's very attractive to me as
well. Due diligence is a little bit easier, right? Yeah. You're not so worried about the value of the property as much. The collateral files usually secure.
Yeah.
It all works. But I wanted to stress upon the fact that if you're bidding every asset that's performing as a performing moving forward, you're asking for a lot of problems. And as well as we said numerous times, if you're bidding on assets that are non-performing strictly based on percentage of UPB or whatever, and you're forgetting the interest rate, you're ignoring the different state it's in, or all the costs, you're really missing out on the big pieces of that note. And if you're doing this with other people's money,
yeah,
you're going to get yourself in bad shit. Luckily, when we first got started, I was using a lot of people's money, but our asset pricing was a lot different back then.
A lot. Yeah.
So today's world, you need to be more precise. You need to know what Texas law is versus Ohio versus, you know, what are your different exit strategies and which exit strategies is the most concerning in each deal.
Yeah.
And be aware of that, because if you're not, you're going to be in a bad spot moving forward with that deal. And as we talk about in our class, the 10-week, even if you want to do the 5-week, we start off with talking about the mindset and figuring out where you're going to be and what you should target first, seconds, performing or non. And then we jump right into building that calculator, truly building a crazy, wild calculator that you can plug and play assets, desired returns, kick out your returns, and know where you should be with a bunch of charts that you can tag things such as stack communications,
right.
such as, you know, what is a Texas time frame? What is Florida's time frame? What states have debt licenses? Things like that is part of the resources that we use in our calculators to know what we should be doing with that asset. And we use those tools in this in our series, which you'll get a hold of, to make sure that we're in a better spot than if we just bid wildly.
Yeah, you've got to be a lot sharper than you used to have to be. 10 years ago, you could pretty much shoot from the hip and you'd hit something. And absolutely. Today, that's not the case. You've got to be a lot sharper. You've got to be a lot more in tune and on the ball with everything. Everything from your due diligence to even your, like you say, your state knowledge, all of those things, you've got to be much more precise and much sharper than you used to have to be. So it's worth it to get that education. It's worth it to practice.
And if you're not sure about the financial calculator, time value things, either the manual or we also show you how to do in a spreadsheet. So you can do 50 assets in a blink of an eye. That class also talks about that because that's a key thing. If you don't know what the present value is, what's a time value, what's a term, what's a rate, how do you calculate this? What does it mean? We talk about that because if you're not learning about that in any of your classes, you're missing the biggest part of a promissory note of any kind is the terms and the numbers. Because you're buying an IOU with a secured property. The secured property is a secondary thing. It just secures the note, the promissory note. So you need to understand those factors and numbers so you get into it. So I encourage you guys, if you are interested, reach out to us. We wanted to show you guys the difference between a performing calculator and non-performing, when to use it.
Yeah.
When you're looking at non-performing assets, there are numerous expenses that go into it, right? And not every expense is into every category. But what you can also target is the different extra strategies and why do they matter? And some of the key things for me is if there's equity or not, right? Yeah. That plays a huge role because my exits change based on equity.
Right. Yeah. And then, and again, it comes down to a lot of preference. Do you want to put in all the extra work for a non-performer that you may not get paid on for, you know, 9-12 months from now? Or are you looking for something that's more, for lack of a better term, predictable, which is what we're saying. It's not always predictable, but it's more
I'm not sure if I lost your audio or not, but I think I lost your audio. I'm not sure if we lost your audio, but I apologize if you did. So for me, I think with regards to the bidding structure and notes, we ran across this recently with an investor that didn't understand why I would bid such a significant drop when the value of the property worth 100 and the balance of the loan was 60,000. They didn't understand why I was not bidding 65 or 70. And they couldn't understand why would I not? I mean, the property worth 70. And what we had to explain to them is I wasn't buying a property. I was buying the note. And if, for those who don't understand, if there's equity in the property and you go forward to buy that note and you're expecting to get the equity, once you foreclose on it, you're not 100% going to get the equity. And the reason is it may sell at auction. And if it goes third party to an outside investor, you lose all that equity in that property because you don't get the property back. Now, you can overbid above the balance of your loan. However, you're not promised to get that asset. So when there's equity in an asset, please don't bid. You know, you're bidding on either one's lower per se, but you're not going to get the equity because it's not there. It's actually the homeowner's equity, not yours.
Exactly. Yeah.
And flip side, right? If that property worth 50 and the UPB is 100, you're most likely going to actually take it back because you're probably going to list it for 45 or 50, trying to get some money out of it and then take it back because you're not going to get it. Or if you sell for 30, and take it and you bought it really well, great. But most likely the equity play comes into the idea of which exit strategy will most likely happen.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen crazy things happen, but
yeah,
it is what it is.
And there's all kinds of people out there predicting values to drop. And so that's something just to, at least to take into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you think that, okay, so in this area, we're looking at prices dropping 5, 10, 20%, but factor that in, because it's, you're not going to foreclose on it today and then sell it tomorrow. You're going to foreclose on it if that's the route you go, and then that you're not going to see the sale for, like I say, 9-12 months from now. So you have to do some kind of prediction at where house prices are going to be at that point.
Sure. When you're doing your bid. And so one of the things that I've been asking for you too is, I'll ask the redundancy ridiculous question. Your calculator has been exactly the same for 10 years, right?
Exactly. I haven't changed a thing.
Yeah. So
being it's still perfect, changing today.
Yeah. So understand the fact that it's going to evolve as you learn things, as you change things, your mindset changes. When you realize certain things, you're going to evolve. So it's not about being precise exactly and leave and forget it. You're adjusting at all time, especially returns.
Yes.
Right. If you're not targeting a higher return now than you were 18 months ago, you're going to win a lot of assets right now.
Yeah.
But the problem is you're going to be in real bad shape, because if you're winning assets at 8-10% and mortgage at 8, it's an extremely low return in given the market we're in right now.
Right. Right.
You know? When you're bidding non-performing assets and you come up with a number that you want to bid at it, but you have 10 assets that you're going to make offers on, do you weed them down from what you think the seller will accept?
To a point.
And what do you weed it on?
Yeah, as long as it still works within my numbers. If I think, if I know certain sellers are gonna want more money or less money. And so I'll go into it with that. In fact, I just did that this morning, where I put in a couple of bids on two different assets. And I said, so, you know, give me your pricing on this. This is what I'm willing to bid. And he called me up and says, okay, one of them's already gone, and here's what we would want for the other. And sure enough, it was much more than I was bidding, which I knew was going to happen, but I just wanted to be sure.
Sure.
Just to know for sure. But you got to know. And I know that this seller is going to accept a higher or lower than another seller. And so I do adjust it a little bit.
Yeah.
Also how much I'm buying. If it's a one-off, I'm probably going to pay a little bit more than if I'm buying, you know, 10 or 20 of loans at a time.
And when we talk about our classes, that, you know, you have to stay fixed on what return you want.
Right.
And then filter down based on what you think the seller will accept.
Yeah.
Because you can't adjust and say, well, okay, I'll move up because the seller wants that, because you may win the asset, but lose the war.
Yeah.
And for me, I'll say, okay, fine. If I'm X percentage of UPB, I'll filter it out, right?
Yeah.
And not that I'm calculating based on UPB, but I'll say, listen, if I'm below, say, 55% UPB, because it's a 2% coupon, I'm most likely going to kick it out and never show the seller that bid, because it's never going to work. And I don't want to make it look bad and get in trouble, or, you know, make it look like it's a bad offer.
Yeah.
So I just avoid it. So for me, I do filter a little bit, but I stay with my return desires and my yield in certain situations. And we talk about in the class, like IRR, yield, and why those two different numbers come to play. And as the years go on, we ask our sellers, what are you looking for? And most likely they're gonna increase it or decrease it based on demand and supply and whatnot. But if you get in with the seller, you can usually ask them, where your target numbers are at.
Right. Yeah. And especially once you've worked up a relationship with them, you can say, listen, so here, I mean, I've even done this where I say, listen, I've got however much, you know, X amount of dollars that I need to spend. And I'm trying to just kind of fit in whatever I can into that number. What kind of pricing are you looking at, so that I can bid appropriately and make bids on, you know, the right assets.
Oh, Patrick, I apologize. I see Patrick said hello to us. Patrick, how are you, man? And I think this is extremely important that people overlook in due diligence. They skip right to due diligence, make an offer, and they don't spend enough time in this calculator. And this calculator makes everything different. Once you start calculating things correctly, it opens up. We had a couple, investors in our last class who have been taught by a lot of people out there, and they didn't realize what all goes into this and why it goes into it, because there are so many factors that go into bidding on an asset, because they can go all different ways. That's a really crucial item. Statute of limitations is something that we don't talk a lot in this space, but that's a huge factor, because if you are beyond statute limitations, there are some situations you can't get out of.
Right. Yeah. There are some where you can advance the date. Other ones where too bad, so sad, you're just out of luck and you can't do anything.
Yeah.
You certainly don't want to be in that situation. Then you just spent money for absolutely nothing.
And there's redemption periods. There are things like, when HOAs jump first, a lot of those things come into play. We also talk about in the class, like, when deed in lieu doesn't work.
Right.
So people think that like modifications, I can modify anything, and deed in lieu will work at all times. Well, unfortunately, deed in lieu doesn't always work, especially if there's a second and third behind it. And we talk about why. Why does that matter? And what changes you need to make sure of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we also dive into due diligence, which comes into play in this. Whenever you run your calculations and you're getting a due diligence, you've got to make sure the numbers that you plugged into your calculator actually match what is in the actual collateral file.
Yeah.
And most people go off the tape, which is great, but you got to make sure those kind of come to play. And then the servicing notes kind of help you out, figure those things out as well.
Yeah. And a lot of other, note teachers, a lot of them do a good job of the due diligence portion of it.
Yeah.
But it's always good to get another opinion.
Yeah,
because Dave does some things that I don't do, and vice versa, that are important to you because, because of whatever potential exit strategy, because of, I don't know, all kinds of different reasons. But we all have just our little bit different take on it. So it's worth it to get that second, third opinion. So what do you do in due diligence? And, 9 out of 10 things will be the same. And then that 10th thing, you go, oh, shoot. Yeah, that's a good idea. I should do that too.
Yeah. Force place insurance, modification agreements, property preservation stuff, all come into play. And understanding that kind of stuff. And sometimes understanding the servicer. If you're with one servicer or another, it makes a difference. But we wanted to also bring up what we're going to be doing in 2 weeks too. I encourage you guys all to share with a friend. We're going to bring on two investors who are definitely not brand new anymore. They've been playing for a while. One will shock you where they previously worked, if you want to share. But these are people who went through the class last time, and they're going to discuss what are they doing today and what the changes are that they have, because it's amazing the turnaround and the eye-waking that when we talked to them, that they were amazed that wasn't spoken in the general conversations in all these, videos and whatnot. Because most stuff we talk about in this class, we don't share publicly at all. We have never done any videos on a lot of this stuff.
Note investors will tell you a whole lot of things, but come on. We're not going to tell you everything.
Yes.
Without some kind of a price. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And guys, we encourage you guys, if you have any questions or pricing or stuff, we charge based on the knowledge and resources that you're going to get in this class. I'm going to tell you that most likely some of the resources you've never seen or will ever have. And some of the information we're going to talk about, I don't know any other classes that, and we have some students who've been through some of the big, big classes, and they don't have the calculator that we have. So I encourage you guys to check it out. But also check out in 2 weeks when we have Candace on and David on December 30th. It's going to be really cool to have that conversation with them when they went through the class and what changes they had and what they're doing today with the information they got.
And for that bid calculator, I know we talked about a lot, but it's crucial. And we'll start you off with something fairly simple like mine, and then you can get it as crazy as you want, like Dave's.
Yeah, absolutely. So guys, I appreciate you tuning in this week. Sorry for the little time change, but we'll look forward to see you guys in 2 weeks. This will be on YouTube and Facebook and everything else in the coming future. But we'll be putting up the event pretty soon for the one that's going to happen in a couple weeks. Hopefully, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. If you have assets you're looking to sell or have questions on, reach out to us, and we'll go from there. I'll put in the comments the link to the page. If you do have questions, again, you can go to our websites and check it out. But yeah. Other than that, hopefully you have a nice, easy weekend. We're going to have a lot of storms here. So I think it'll be a staying inside weekend for us.
We're good for today, but like starting tomorrow, the temperature just falls off a cliff. So it's going to be very cold the next week. That's
well, hopefully Christmas is a nice one. I heard the possibility for snow. So
should be a nice one. Should be a nice one. We'll have some snow on the ground and everything else. Should be beautiful.
Well, have a good week, my man. Have a good weekend, everyone out there in the social media world. And we'll see you soon.
All right.